So I should write larger,
Yeah, big platform for me.
I guess. Okay. So let E be a projective OK module of finite rank called N, and H an Hermitian metric on E. I will be interested in the successive minima of EH. So they are defined as follows. Well, whether the logarithmic of the successive minima. So mu I is the smallest mu in R, such that there exists I vector in E. Which are k linearly independent, in other words, they are independent in E tensor k, and such that each vector as norm less than exponential of mu, log of norm of V alpha less or equal to mu. Where here the norm on, of V alpha is taken to be the subnorm of the norm in each complex embedding. So, of course, this is an increasing sequence. And I will be sometimes interested in the average of these numbers. Okay. So it's a natural question to ask for inequalities about these numbers when we are in a geometric situation. So what do I mean by this? Well, first, I look at the k linear span of E. Yeah. And I consider a curve xk in the projective bundle of the dual of E. So its k is smooth, projective, and geometrically irreducible. So I call G the genus of its k, and D the degree. Now I assume that this projective bundle, projective embedding of SK is a good one in the sense that it's given by a complete linear series. In other words, I'm assuming that EK is canonically isomorphic to E0 XK O of 1. So the map from EK to E0 XK O of 1 is an isomorphism. So in other words, I could start the other way around, start from a curve, a line bundle. What? Genus of XK.
Oh,
smooth projective, geometrically irreducible curve. Yeah. So, in other words, I could start from XK, a line bundle, a very ample line bundle on XK, and look at the corresponding projective embedding. So the question is, what what constraints on the surfaces minima of E come out from this geometric picture. So for that, I introduce a notation. I denote by X the Zariski closure of this K in the projective bundle, projective space of the dual of E. So now I get something over OK. I look at the tautological line bundle on X equipped with a metric coming from E. So O of 1 is a quotient of E, I get the metric on O of 1. And the height of this K, the projective height, or maybe the fucking height, is defined as the arithmetic degree of the self-intersection of O1 on X, on this Zariski closure. So this is a classical height of the curve for this projective embedding. And we shall introduce a normalized height. So we define Hn of xk from h of xk as the following. So the height of xk divided by 2d, remember that d is the degree of xk, multiplied by the degree of k over q, plus the average of the successive minima. So this is the variant of the height, which I call Hn of xk. So I call it the normalized height because in both works, there is a notion of normalized height, which is very close to that. Namely, he considers the normalized height of this K, he defines it as the same term, height of XK divided by 2D K over Q, plus minus the degree, the arithmetic degree of A0 of X, O1 for the L2 norm, divided by n. So you see it's the same definition as I gave, except the second term, instead of being the degree of the lattice, is the average of the successive minima. But now we have the theorem of Minkowski, which tells you that the average of successive minima is given by log of the covolume. So these two things are essentially equal up to log of discriminant. Because in the Minkowski theorem, we have log of discriminant. So this term and this term are the same, except for change of matrix and for log of discriminant. But apart from this, they play the same role. I can now state the result. Theorem 1, if D is at least 2G plus 1, the normalized height of K is greater or equal to G than D minus 2G divided by D2 plus D minus 2G squared mu minus mu 1. In particular, since the sequence is increasing, the average of the successive minima is at least the first one, because the mu1 is the smallest of the successive minima. So the term on the right is at least zero. So we have in particular the inequality that the nominal height is non-negative. So this is the first result. And the second result will be about the other successive minima than mu1, namely there exists a constant depending only on the degree such that, well, I'm assuming that the genus is non-zero, and I consider successive minima for almost all values of the index, so I take k between 3 and d minus 2g minus 3, then I have the following inequality, mu n plus 1 minus k minus mu is at least minus k sin of x minus c. So we'll get some inequality which is better when k is small, which means that we look at higher successive minima. So here it's a negative term, and we're saying that the difference of this successive minimum with the average is at least minus k times this normalized height. So of course there is a possibility that the lattice is stable or semi-stable, that is all the nuclei have roughly the same size. In that case, this is zero and this is at least zero, so there is no contradiction. But what this inequality is saying is that somehow the lattice is not so far of being semi-stable. That is, the distance between successive minima and the average can be bounded in terms of the normalized height. So that's the statement. So I will discuss a little the proof of the theorem. And the proof is inspired from the proof that any projective curve is semi-stable in the sense of Mumford. There is a theorem by Giesecker and Morrison, who are students of Mumford, and they prove that xk, the Schau point, is semi-stable in the sense of invariant theory. We shall take the proof of this statement, and we shall take the same proof, but at some point some parameter will be different, will have to do with the successive minima, but the inequalities I will be using are those which are in the proof of Morrison. So it's inspired, but using really the proof of Morrison. So we proceed as follows. So what I will do now is standard geometric invariance theory thing to do in this situation. Namely, we consider first n vector in E. And we assume that they form a basis of Vk. So when m is big enough, the map from ek times m, which is again 0,01 times m, the coproduct map to a0 ek O of m is surjective. That's because of one example. So we call special basis And again, this is just taken from the paper of Morrison, a special basis of ASIO HKOM is a basis made of image of simple vectors here. It's a basis made of what I would call monomials that is tensor product phi of V1 tensor alpha 1 Vn to the power alpha n of the right degree, so alpha 1 plus alpha n equals n. And any vector is a linear combination of these ones, and I'm taking, I call a special basis, a basis which is made of monomials, just image of a pure tensor. Okay, that's one thing. The other thing is we fix some real numbers. So in the proof of Morrison, these numbers will be the degree of t in some one parameter subgroup. The degree of each of the variable t1, tn. So that will be the real numbers r1 to rn. In our case, as you will see, r1, rn will be related to log of successive minima. But the theory can be done abstractly with any set of real numbers R1, Rn. So we define the weight of the different object we have with respect to this choice of real numbers. So the weight of Vi is Ri. The weight of V1 tensor alpha 1 tensor Vn alpha n is sigma alpha I Ri. And if you have a monomial, so if you have U, which is the image of V1 tensor alpha 1 Vn tensor alpha n, well, it can be the image of this simple tensor, but it can be at the same time the image of another simple tensor. So we are interested in the smallest way of representing U. So we take what we call weight of U, the infimum over all X monomials such that Cx equals U of the weight of U. So this is the weight. So this is X. I hope I'm clear. I mean, the weight of a pure tensor is sigma phi Ri, and when I go to the cohomology of Rn, I look at the smallest weight I could get such that U is C of this simple tensor. So now I can define the weight of a special basis. It will be the same for U in the basis of the weight of U. And finally, we define WRM to be the infimum over all special bases of the weight of V. Okay. So now for any integer m, and depending on the choice of these real numbers R1, Rn, I get the real number, which is this this weight. When we look at this number, when m goes to infinity, And here is a result due to Mansard. The following fact is true, that if my real numbers are in fact integers in decreasing order, there is an asymptotic development for WR of M. So there is a number ER in N such that this number, depending on M, is ER N squared over 2 plus big O of M. So there is an asymptotic development of weight 2, degree 2. Okay. So the proof will go by showing some upper bounds for ER. So we look for upper bounds for ER. So this is done by combining several results, and the first result is due to Gitaker, it's the following. So let VI be the linear span of VI plus 1 VN in EK, and consider the linear projection from P of EK dual to P of VI dual. We look at this linear projection and we denote by EI the loss of degree of the curve by this projection. So D minus degree, so call it PI, of PI XK. So the degree here will drop by linear projection, and I call EI the drop of degree when going to this smaller projective space. Then we have the following proposition. Due to Gitaker, namely, for any choice of indices I less or equal to I0, etc., less or equal to IL equals N, of L plus 1 integers, we have the following inequality. ER is at most the sum from G equals 0 to L, Rij minus Rij plus 1 times Eij plus Eij plus 1. So this is a general inequality. For any choice of integers, of L integers, we have that ER is bounded this way. So this is the first proposition. And the second proposition, which will allow us to find an upper bound for ER, that is, we look at the right-hand side now, and we want to find an upper bound for it, is a result of Morrison, which I prefer not to write myself, so that's proposition two. So we look at the minimum of the right-hand side. So F is the minimum of the right-hand side in Gitaker upper bound. The smaller, the best upper bound we get by Gitaker inequality. Then there is a way to separate the variable EI and R which are mixed in this expression here, one gets the following inequality. S is less equal to some complicated expression in terms of the EI, but a simple expression in terms of the RJ, the sum of RJ minus RI. So this is a crucial combinatorial lemma in the proof of Morrison and in what we shall do. So we have proposition one, which says that ER is bounded above by an expression like this. And now we have Morrison, which tells you that this expression is bounded this way. And in fact, we have a third piece of information, so now I will explain the proof of theorem 1. What happens is we shall use upper bounds for the EI. You cannot see? What? You want the slide again? Okay. Thank you. Yeah, but then... okay. So you're really an expert. The question is, what will happen when I change again the transparency? I mean, so... okay. So what happens is that we have some a priori estimate from above for the drop of degrees. So what happens is that from Riemann error for the curve xk and Clifford's theorem, we get some simple upper bound for EI, and which are the following. EI is less or equal to I minus 1 if I minus 1 is at most d minus 2g, and slightly more complicated, ei is at most I minus 1 plus alpha if I minus 1 is of the form d minus 2g plus alpha, where alpha is greater or equal to 0. So the first one is Riemann error and the second is Clifford. So we have upper bound for the ei. So when we want to find an upper bound for ER, we do the following. First, we have the upper bound of Giesecke, which is a combination of the EI. Now we take the upper bound of the EI given here. So we get the same expression as Giesecke, but with explicit numbers. And now we apply to the result the theorem of Morrison. So we shall get that we have an upper bound in terms of sigma I minus IN, with a complicated number, which is the maximum of this EI square and so on, that you obtain by taking the maximal value here. Okay, so conclusion is the following. ER is bounded by a function which I will call psi of R, which is the following. 2d square divided by d square plus d minus 2g2 sigma ri. Here I am assuming that rn is 0, so I don't have to worry about I minus rn. Okay. So this is an inequality we have for integers, but if I r1, r2, rn are real numbers, we still have an inequality up to small correction. WR of M is the same as CR plus epsilon m square over 2 plus big O of m, where O of m depends on epsilon. So we go from integers to any real number just by homogeneity of the function psi of r. So this is the goal we had, which was to find an upper bound for the leading term with the asymptotic expansion of WR of m when m goes to infinity. Okay. But now we shall choose the real numbers. And we proceed as follows. We know that we can choose vectors in E, the length of which are the successive minima. So we choose U1 Vn in such a way that the log of the norm of Vi is mu n plus 1 minus I. So this is a choice of vectors. And now we choose a weight, and the weight we take, I, will be by definition this difference, mu n plus 1 minus I minus mu 1. So we get a sequence of real numbers, I, the last one being 0, which is exactly the condition we have for the inequality before. So we have some inequality in terms of these numbers. But this inequality really is really meaningful because of the following. Assume I have a monomial phi of u1 tensor alpha 1, etc., vn tensor alpha n. In a 0 is k of m. Then I can choose the, I can evaluate the norm of u. So log of u for the subnorm is less or equal to the log of the norm of v1 tensor alpha 1 vn tensor alpha n. Which is sigma alpha I log of Vi. So for any way I write U as an image of a simple tensor product, of a simple tensor, the subnorm of U is bounded by essentially the weight of U. So from this, by taking the smallest way of representing u, I get that the subnorm of u is less or equal to the weight of u, and since I have shifted everything by u1, I have to add mu1. So you see now that the weight makes sense here as an upper bound for the norm of my vectors in a 0 xk om. Okay. So now let me consider a special basis. So this is made of simple tensor product. Now we introduce the covolume of the lattice A0XOM in A0XOM tensor R. So let chi be minus log of the volume of a 0 x om tensor R divided by the lattice 0 x om. So we are interested in its number, and by Adama inequality, since I have a special basis, the log of the co-volume will be the log bounded by the sum of the log of the vectors in the basis with the correct sign. So I get minus k over q sigma u in b log of u for the sup norm, and then there is a technical point which add some logarithmic of discriminant, but a small power of n. Okay, so in other words, chi, what I prove is chi is at least minus k over q times the sum for any vector in B of wt, the weight of u, plus m u1 plus something which is like O of m, because 0 SKOM is at most linear in m. Okay, so now we know something about the weight of u. We know the inequality that we deduced for WRM from Giesecke plus Morrison plus Riemannauer or Clifford. So we have some inequality bounding this from above. So we get that this is at least minus kq psi of r plus a small epsilon plus 2d u1 plus big O of m. This is by the computation we did before. So now we have a lower bound for chi. Well, on the other hand, we have the Hilbert-Samuel in the arithmetic context, which tells you the following. Chi is equal to the height of this here up to lower order. Say it again. Absolutely, thank you. Yeah. So the limiting term of the lower bound for chi is this expression, and on the other hand, we have a general fact, which is that chi, log of covolume of the lattice, is given is of degree 2, with leading terms the height of xk, which we could take as a definition, actually. So we get that the height of xk is at least minus k over q psi of r plus epsilon plus 2d u1 with psi of r computed before, so psi of r is 2d squared divided by d squared plus d minus 2g2 sum of the r. So this is 2d squared n divided by d squared plus d minus 2g, 2d2 times mu minus mu1. Okay? So we have now that the height of xk is bounded by some multiple of mu minus mu1. And if you remember theorem 1, it was precisely an inequality of this type. So now we have some simple manipulation to do to get theorem 1, which is that the height of this k is bounded by a combination of mu minus mu 1 times some coefficients. Okay, so this is the end of the proof of theorem 1, that the normalized height of sk is bounded from below by a multiple of mu minus mu 1. Theorem 2 is proved essentially by the same method, but with different choices of constant. So to prove theorem 2, I will not give all the details, but for proving theorem 2, we choose not the same vectors and not the same real numbers Ri. So we choose. So again, we have x1, xn in E vectors with mu n plus 1 minus I equals log of the normal xi. And we take not exactly this vector, but a combination of them. So we take vi equals xi plus some multiple of xi minus 1, or xi. So this is for k plus 1 I so for I between k plus 1 and n minus 2, we choose such a combination, and we take xi otherwise. I will explain a little later what is ni, in the how we choose ni. So this means that we have a projection from PVI to PVI plus 1, and before the center was the dual basis of VI. So we had a projection, and when we project to VI, we lose EI in the degree. When we project to VI plus 1, we lose EI plus 1, and so on. Here, we shall choose the vector so that the projection does not change the degree. So if we move a little the center, the linear projection from PVI to PVI plus 1 will not change the degree of the curve. So we take advantage of that. So we choose the new basis VI in such a way that the image of XK does not change degree by the projection from VI to VI plus 1. So this means that we have an additional information, which is that the drop of degree is equal to the drop of degree at the k step, so k is fixed, and comes in the statement of theorem 2. EI is equal to AK if I is between K and N minus 2. So this means that our choice of the EI is different, because instead of using Riemannauer and Clifford to have a bound from above, we can also add the fact that they don't change, that EI doesn't change as between step k and step n minus 2. When you get step n minus 2, you'll get a p1 and then a point, so of course you change the degree. Okay. Now we apply the two propositions, the one of Wiesenthal and the one of Morrison, and we apply the inequality EI equals EK and Clifford and Riemannauer, and we get an upper bound. an upper bound for the leading term in WRM. Now we choose Ri also in a different way, namely we choose log xi minus 1 minus log xn if k plus 1 less or equal to I less or equal to n minus 2 and log xi minus log xn otherwise. So now we get some inequality, which is as follows. We get, so it's a little more complicated, we get an inequality which is dk times un plus 1 minus k minus mu plus the height of xk divided by the degree of k over q plus 2d mu is at least 2d minus n plus 1 dk mu minus mu 1 okay, this is an inequality you get. And the, in this inequality, there is a constant bk, and the constant bk is the same, is a constant we have over there, in front of sum of I minus rn. We have a complicated constant, which is max of vi squared and so on. Now, ei has some constraints which are not exactly the same as before, namely, you have Clifford and Riemann-Rauer bound, but we also have the information that EI is equal to EK. And then you compute BK, which is this constant here. So this is, you get something, but you can estimate BK and you get theorem 2. So I will not give all the detail. But that's the structure of the proof. So we get the theorem 2, which is as follows. So by simplifying and evaluating BK, we get that there is a constant such that this difference is minus K, the normalized height of this K minus C. I have time. I guess I started on 9:30. So I want to explain a technical point is what I just said. Namely, so the vector xi was modified by a multiple of xi minus 1 in such a way that the center of the linear projection from PVI dual to PVI plus 1 does not change the degree of the curve. So you move a little the center, instead of taking xi, you take xi plus ni xi minus 1. Okay? But as usual in number theory, if you do such thing, you have to estimate ni, because ni will come in the inequality one way or the other. So what we can do is estimate ni because of the following result of Claire Voisin. So I asked her what if this was true, and as usual she proved it. I mean, except when it's wrong, where she proves it's wrong, but. In any case, if she answered the question, to bound ni, what you really need is the following proposition, a theorem. Assume I have a curve, smooth, say, smooth integral, or maybe not, integral projective curve in the projective space, of degree d at least 3, and assume pn is at least p3, n at least 3. Then there exists a constant AD and a finite set of points outside C such that the number of points is at most A of D. That's the first condition. And the second condition is for any point which is not in C and not in this exceptional set sigma, the linear projection of center the point from Pn to Pn minus 1 maps C birationally onto its image. In other words, the degree does not drop down when you go from Pn to Pn minus 1. So this is a theorem by Segre, if I remember. Birationally. So the degree doesn't change. No? No, the curve is not smooth. It's an integral. So the fact that you can move the find a center such that the image of the curve keeps the same degree in the from Pn to Pn minus 1 was known by Segre. The point is to look at the proof and make it effective in the sense that we have a bound on the number of such centers which is a function of D only. So, and we can use this result of Clair-Voisin, which I will put back in a second, by saying that for choosing Ni here, I have A of D choices. That is, any choice, if I take different values of Ni, I get different centers. So at some point, I will be outside sigma, and the projection will have the right degree. So let me put back the Clair-Voisin theorem. Okay, so if you have this effective choice of the good projection, you can use them in the proof, and you get theorem 2. So thank you very much.